First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
What would a people's budget for Jacksonville look like? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. And just ahead this morning, why a coalition of local groups says they want big changes in the way the city pays for services. Give us a call as we talk about this. It's 549-2937. Then later, the community is coming together around rising COVID cases and an urgent push for vaccinations. That's later. But first this hour, Mayor Lenny Curry this week presented his proposed budget for the next year to the Jacksonville City Council. He's not calling for any tax increases, and at the same time, fire and police would get more funds, sizable bumps. For police, the budget would go from $484 million in the current fiscal year to $502 million. That increase would mostly go to funding its Department of Investigation and Homeland Security and its Department of Patrol and Enforcement. The city council will have to sign off on this budget. Of course, not everyone is happy with the idea of increasing funding for law enforcement. The Jacksonville Community Action Committee, in response to the mayor's proposed budget, released its own people's budget. They say it's an alternative, and they're calling on council members to pass a budget that they say should directly invest into programs they believe will increase opportunity, livable wages, and more robust social and public services throughout the city. So what would a people's budget look like? Well, Michael Sampson is chair of the Jacksonville Community Action Committee, and he's on the line. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you on the show. 549-2937 to join us. So JSO receives about 40% of the city's overall budget. Your organization is arguing it's time to change, since despite year-over-year increases in law enforcement funding, we haven't seen a decrease in crime. Tell us about the people's budget and what you would like to see the city spend its tax dollars on, and what you would like to see prioritized.
Thank you. So the people's budget is a new method of reimagining how we view public safety in the city, and also how we view our tax dollars as the priorities that we have as a city. So anytime that the budget season, it seems like the police are always kind of prioritized in regards to the city's budget. 40% of the city's budget going to law enforcement, and you have other social programs of the department that could overall, if they receive greater investment, could greatly increase the quality of life, and in our opinion, lead to decrease in crime. Those historically have been neglected, and when you see those increases, let's say, for example, in the mayor's budget, he calls for a $50 million fund that will go towards quality of life, you know, in which there will be a special city council committee that will decide how to disperse those funds. You know, $50 million is a drop in the bucket compared to $500 million that you see going towards policing. So it always seems that every budget season, it seems that, you know, the programs that, you know, will have a direct effect on reducing crime and also getting to the root issues of crime don't get the amount of funding they get. However, the sheriff's office every year has seen an increase in their budget, and in return, you know, taxpayers really haven't received the dividends from that investment. And what we're saying is the city needs to rethink its whole strategy about what it invests in with our taxpayer dollars, invest in the root issues of solving crime, as opposed to this model that seems to happen every year in which we think that we can police our way out of poverty, police our way out of crime. And it's just shown in our history the past couple of years when we raised this issue, has shown that, you know, simply increasing JSO share of the budget every year has not led to, you know, an increase of quality of life for Jacksonville residents.
Give us a call, Jacksonville, as we talk about this people's budget proposal and the mayor's proposed budget, 549-2937. Okay, so then tell us how you would reallocate the dollars. Give me an example, if you could, of where you'd like to see some line items changed around in the budget.
Well, for example, I mean, the sheriff this year came asking for, I believe, a $29 million increase, and the mayor said that he will fully fund that. For example, last year, the sheriff only asked for a $6 million increase. The mayor gave him half of that. And I do think it was a lot of the protest that you saw led to that. Like the protest we saw last year was calling for an end to long equality, historical neglect. So I think you saw from the mayor's office a solution in which he tried to, he put forth his gas tax to invest in infrastructure and neighborhoods and using that as a means to fund some of these projects. However, like we said, you have ample money, 40% going towards the sheriff's office. So, for example, in our people's budget, if ideally you were to reallocate from a JSO's budget, an example of an increase that you could see is perhaps $15 more million going towards the Division of Mental Health Services to provide more mental health, especially a year after COVID, in which you saw our citizens really, struggling with mental health in regards to lockdowns and just the general social strain that society had from the COVID-19 pandemic and still is experiencing. So if you reallocated funding from the sheriff's office budget towards more mental health, you could see a direct, correlation towards a healthier citizen, as opposed to, investing that money into police like what we've seen. Or you can reallocate some of that funding towards a homeless elimination incentive program. In our people's budget, we call for $15.5 million towards the creation of new, brand new homeless shelters, which in a lot of ways would help work towards solving the homeless issue that we do have in Jacksonville. And as well, think about an additional increase. We call it for a $20 million increase to public libraries and additional staff. What this would do is also help, our libraries, increase the hours, give our kids something to do after school as well, something that I used to do back in the 90s when I was growing up, kind of aging myself, or in the early 2000s. Hmm. But, this is all part of, taking dollars and cents, for example, if you're giving the JSO the $29 million increase they're asking for, you are giving, for example, UF Health an increase to $35 million. Why not give some of that money you're giving to the sheriff's office towards UF Health, especially in regards to the pandemic, and we see numbers increasing, there's going to be a greater need for investment in healthcare in this city. But if you're kind of it's a city of priorities. And if you're prioritizing your relationships with the sheriff's office, your relationships with the sheriff, then you want to see less of a priority on social services and social issues that many Jacksonville residents have been going to City Hall, City Council, raising for years with the City Council and with the mayor's administration.
We're speaking with Michael Sampson, chair of the Jacksonville Community Action Committee, about their proposed people's budget. A coalition of groups plans to rally at City Council next Tuesday at 4 o'clock to demand a people's budget for the city. This, as Mayor Curry has put forth a proposed budget for Jacksonville for the next fiscal year. About 40% of the budget will go toward the JSO. 549-2937. Give us a call on Facebook. A listener writes, it's a common theme played out again and again in the city budget that historically and chronically neglected communities are still being underserved. JSO needs a wholesale reorganization and extensive reform before any additional dollars are given to them over meeting the needs of the citizens living and working in this city. Okay, Michael Sampson, what about the other side of this? When some people listening to you talk right now on this show are hearing you call for reallocating taxpayer dollars away from public safety and to other kinds of initiatives that you argue would help reduce crime and improve quality of life for Jacksonville. But what a lot of people hear is that you are calling to defund the police. That has become an incredibly controversial rallying cry over the last few years. What's your response to those who think you're simply just calling to defund the police?
Well, I mean, I think that's just a kind of a slogan that has, I guess, worked in regards to, you know, we're talking reallocation. We're talking, let's say, the $29 million that the sheriff's office is trying to get. We're talking about investing that into the community. And it is our local right, home rule, to be able to determine how our budgets are determined. It isn't determined by Tallahassee and Governor Ron DeSantis, which HP1 sought to do. But for the folks who say that, you know, Jacksonville for the past couple, five, six, 7 years, at least 7 years under the mayor's administration, has not defunded the police. In fact, they've gone up on the sheriff's office budget exponentially since the mayor first got into office. And what has that resulted for you who are accusing this of defunding the police? You know what I'm saying? That's my logic. The results speak for themselves. Jacksonville has not defunded the police. Jacksonville has not had any type of civilian police accountability. Jacksonville has done none of those things in 7 years under the mayor's administration. What have we seen? We've seen high crime.
Yeah, and certainly, the old saying is the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. But that said, okay, the pie for JSO in this current proposed budget is about 40%. What slice of pie do you think the police should have? What percentage of the budget?
I mean, what we're calling for in our people's budget is a reallocation. Of course, our people's budget is a template. It's an ideal about how we should reimagine public safety. We're calling for them to get 20% of the budget and reallocate and have that funding towards these other social services, which would put them in line with the same amount of funding that the fire department gets. You know, no one ever calls for defunding the fire department. You know, no one ever opposes that. But in fact, you've seen kind of a coupling of the fire department and the sheriff's office when we talk about public safety. But advocates like myself and others, we are not talking about the fire department because people see the fire department doing a service. And sometimes people see law enforcement doing the service, but then you have to compare that to the amount of investment they're getting in comparison to the tax dollars that we're putting into it. And if people aren't seeing, you know, murder rates drop and people aren't seeing a solution with everything that we've seen, there was a spot track center that the sheriff wanted funded a couple of years ago. There's been numerous technologies that he's talked about doing in regards to reducing crime, yet we've seen no reduction. And also, on top of that, you've seen numerous cases of civilians. You know, there was a report released a couple of months ago in regards to JSO released that report in regards to civilian complaints. You had a huge amount of civilian complaints in regards to JSO even last year. So we're talking about, you know, making sure that they're held accountable in regards to the money that they're spending. But even you've seen this conversation, Melissa, I'm not sure if you saw the talk about CARES Act funds going towards paying down Jacksonville Sheriff's Office overtime. And even yesterday, there was talk about American Rescue Plan funds going towards paying off JSO SWAT team expenses.
Yeah.
This is money that was designed specifically for COVID-19, and we're seeing the upshot in that. However, you know, we're seeing city leaders talk about that money going more towards policing, which again, you know, brings us back to the fundamental question of why we're demanding the people's budget. What does our budget reflect? You know, and what does our tax dollars reflect? What we invest in reflects our city's priorities.
Let's go to lots of calls now for Michael Sampson of the Jacksonville Community Action Committee and their proposed people's budget for Jacksonville. Elbon on the north side. Elbon. Go ahead.
Good morning. It's very interesting conversation with the people's budget and the reallocation purpose. So all I would like to suggest in terms of reallocations, we have so many beaten down neighborhoods where banks are not making any loans. And those places are pretty much incubators for crime. Basically, criminals use those spaces. and small investors cannot have loans to repair those places, and absolutely the homeowners cannot find any bank to give them a loan. So why don't we go ahead and create a system in the city where those small investors and those homeowners can have loans from the city to improve those property and use them and kick criminals out without having more police to lock them up. So let's wait on that and see.
And, you know,
how we can better serve our communities.
There are some initiatives like that, Elban. There are some nonprofits doing that kind of work, although I completely agree with you that the need is so great that it can often seem like a drop in the bucket. Michael Sampson, your thoughts.
One of the things in the people's budget that we're calling for, and it was actually recommended by the Jacksonville Charter Revision Committee, is the creation of an urban core development authority, which would coordinate public and private resources to address poverty. And, you know, especially in Northwest Jackson, you actually have programs like the Northwest, I believe it's called the Community Development Fund, which
that's what they do.
To do that. However, how much of a budget did they get? You know, last time I checked, I think last year, I haven't checked the mayor's budget on that this year, but let's say it was around only a couple million bucks.
Do you think there's an ideological block that perhaps, you know, the majority of the members of the city council and others in positions of influence, they perceive, right or wrong, that putting money into those kinds of initiatives won't be effective, that it won't be successful enough to justify a much greater expenditure?
I do think you do see that. I mean, especially in regards to, and, you know, let's be real, like we're dealing with the effects of consolidation. So we have a lot of forces on the city council that don't represent the urban core and don't see the need for development and reinvestment in those areas in a major way. So, of course, other sides of town get prioritized, and we've seen that development, you know, for years and decades. The urban core and the amount of tax revenue that came from the urban core essentially subsidized development all over Jacksonville, and we need to see a reversal of that in effect because the urban core has lagged behind. So I do think you see an ideological method in which any type of funding that goes towards the urban core, that goes towards funding historically on a neglected neighborhood, it's shot down because it isn't my district. You know, I have to worry about, you know, this, I have to worry about my district, which doesn't have that, those years of historical neglect. So you are also dealing with an ideological component.
Yeah. Let's get a few more calls on, if I could. Peter on the South Side. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, hi, good morning. Police and fire have notoriously been the third rail, okay? And it's only effective because city council is looking over their shoulder trying to be reelected. Now, what is the job of the police? Is it crime prevention or is it coming in and cleaning up afterwards? The answer, I think, is crime prevention, and our police department and many others have completely failed in that area. If there is crime on the west side, then we don't need police hanging around Queens Harbor on the east side. We need police presence, a heavy presence, all day and all night long, either walking or biking. We don't need them driving around in their car. So I think that we should task the police with saying, how can you do your job better and what resources do you need?
And you're talking about
crime prevention.
You're talking about police reform more broadly, Peter, and I appreciate your thoughts. Michael Sampson, what about Peter's first comment that no rising politician wants to get on the wrong side of the police and fire unions? That is a big political hurdle that you and your coalition has in trying to convince local office holders to give these entities less money.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know that. And especially in regards to the police union, finance chair Ron Salem, I remember him last year voting against a measure around the people's budget, around reallocation, mentioning that he, the day before, spoke to the police union president So they have a strong influence on these politicians, but then again, it's, you know, you have 2,500 members, you know, part of the police union, you know, you have almost, you know, 800,000 to 900,000 Jacksonville residents. So it's up to those politicians to kind of see, you know, where the tea leaves are blowing and, you know, what they should do. But also on the caller's point in regards to policing, I mean, the north side, I work off of Pearl Street, grew up off of Long Branch and Pearl Street. You know, you see police cars everywhere, and that doesn't translate to a reduction in crime. So a part of reimagining public safety that we're talking about with the people's budget is saying the north side and parts of the east side are very heavily policed, yet you still see an uptick in crime. So police don't prevent crime. Police pretty much come after crime has already happened. So in regards to crime prevention, we have to stop thinking about, you know, just people with guns stopping crime. We have to think about the root causes of that, which is our people's budget kind of seeks to address. And the other thing I wanted to mention, Melissa, is what we've seen, especially in Jacksonville, is a lack of excessive black small businesses, especially in regards to getting city contracts and getting public dollars. So part of our people's budget is, if we're going to see all this development, which is a good thing for the city in terms of fixing infrastructure, we also want to make sure that minority contractors are also getting some of that business, because that's wealth that can go back to our neighborhood, which in turn will lead to more neighborhood development, which in turn, our calculus will lead to also reduction of crime.
Daryl in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Daryl.
Good morning, Melissa. Great show. It's been a subject I don't understand for a long time. My understanding is your budget for the police department was like $970 million. That's like almost $1 billion. Maybe that's a wrong number. I don't know. But regardless, the idea that the police can fail and we increase their money, I don't know any place in the world or America where the more you fail, the more money you get. Seems to me if you're the murder capital of the world, you need to change what you're doing, or murder capital of Florida, you need to change what you're doing and stop giving them more money. You need to give them money someplace else, because the sheriff's department is failing. They're a failure. I mean, you fire people that have failed. So if they can't...
Look, I hear your frustration, but, you know, we need a police department. Yeah.
We need a new sheriff. We need a new police department. Start firing people. Start at the top. Start firing people down. And when they start getting results, then you can start talking about increasing your budget. But you don't get more money to fail.
Daryl, thanks for the call. You know, there is an election coming up, Michael Sampson. There's already a declared candidate for sheriff, Lakeisha Burton. She may be more receptive, possibly, to some of the proposals your coalition is presenting. So do you plan to get involved in the political world as the campaigns for local office heat up?
Well, we definitely plan in regards to local elections to really put forth our issues and educate the candidates on our issues. Hopefully they'd want to be educated on the issues that we're talking about in regards to city funding, about police accountability. So, I mean, we do see a ray of light in regards to there is a new minute. There will be a new sheriff soon, a year and a half from now, a new mayor, a new city council person, possibly. So we will get, you know, very involved in making sure the issues that, you know, thousands of people who come to our rallies to talk to us have put forth, and we will be very involved. And, you know, I'm very much curious about the candidacy of Ms. Burton. I have met her before. I met her husband before. They all seem like good people, and I'm interested to see what they put forth. You know, I think we've kind of seen so far from her candidacy who she is as a person, and it seems like she's very well known. I would love to hear more about her plans, especially with regards to the concerns people have towards police accountability and feeling like there's more transparency coming from the sheriff's office.
And in the meantime, you'll be rallying with some coalition partners next Tuesday at City Hall. We'll follow the story. Michael Sampson, Jacksonville Community Action Committee. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Coming up, why city leaders and business leaders all across the region are now urgently begging people to get vaccinated. That's coming up, plus some good news for your Wednesday, but up next.
I guess I've always kind of known about the Bahamian mail boats. I hadn't really thought about Norway and Indonesia and the other archipelagos that have got mail boat systems.
How you can see islands all over the world on the cheap by mail boat. We'll tell you how next. Well, there's a low-budget way to see the islands of the Caribbean and places around the world, too. And it's one that a First Coast traveler knows how to do so well that he's sharing the secret with all of us. Author Fred Brayman tells you all about it in his new book, Cruising by Mailboat, History, Culture, and Adventure in the Bahamas. Take a listen.
Hey, Fred, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Melissa. It's my pleasure, and thanks for the opportunity.
So I'd never heard about people doing this till you told me about your book, but mail boats are pretty popular around the world, connecting islands and maritime communities. What got you onto all of this and seeing the world on a mail boat or seeing the islands on a mail boat?
Well, it was it happened in where I got the idea. I guess I've always kind of known about the Bahamian mail boats. I hadn't really thought about Norway and Indonesia and the other archipelagos that have got mail boat systems. But I knew about the Bahamian ones because I've been going there on my own boat for about 35 years. And just one day, I was it was in 2012, I was off on a long trip. I was in the Berry Islands, which is an island group just to the east of Bimini, if you know Bimini, just off Miami. And a mailboat happened to come in and docked, and I didn't have anything to do, so I just watched it. And I watched them unload crates of chickens and pallets of sod and a small tree and a goat and pallets of all kinds of other things, water and beer, anything that the little communities, needed to survive. And then a few people got off, and I thought, that might be something that's fun to do someday. And so I kind of put it away in the back of my mind and didn't think about it again for, quite some time, even though it was still there on the subsurface somewhere. But in 2017, I decided to give it a try. So I called up a couple of old college friends and asked them if they'd be interested. And I came right back and said, yeah, I'm in. So that's how it started. That's how we got the idea.
Okay. And mail boats are, a practical way for people that live on the water or live in remote areas to get their mail. But what's it like as a traveler to travel on a mail boat?
Well, it's pretty much akin to, getting on a tramp steamer and going across to Europe. People have done that for, forever. And the one big difference, when you get on a tramp steamer, you're going to, be at sea for maybe 10 days in between continents. But on a mail boat, You substitute just a series of overnight trips, mostly overnight trips between islands. So most of the boats are, it's very modest. There's no casinos. There's nothing like you would see on a cruise ship. It's a working cargo boat that carries mail and will also carry passengers. And typically you might have, on most of the mail boats, you might have, 10 to 15 passengers, maybe a few more than that. And we got nothing to do but sit around the lounge and the, which is a very modest thing. It's kind of like a kitchen, and so we get to know folks really well and really relate to them on a personal level. And they're just about all Bahamians. In fact, we have never encountered on the many trips that we've taken another tourist type like us on
really?
Any of them.
So yeah, this is sort of an under the radar mode of travel then for Americans.
Yeah, it is. But people are interested in it though. I've been given talks at yacht clubs and things, especially during the COVID era here now in Zoom. They're always looking for somebody to talk about something, and it really kind of goes over really well with the crowd that are, used to getting on boats and traveling to islands anyway. And most of the sales of my book have been to people like that, that have also known about mail boats and thought that they may like to do that one day, but they just never got around to it. I researched, when I started writing my book, I researched the literature that was out there about traveling on mail boats, and there was virtually none. There were a couple of magazine articles, 10 years apart, but nobody had written a book about it or gave any thought to, if you're going to try to offer the opportunity up to somebody else, what would you have to tell them? And so that's what I tried to do.
Well, COVID cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are rising once again in Jacksonville and in surrounding counties. In fact, we've become a hot spot for the resurgence of the disease. The push to get more people in this area vaccinated is growing more urgent by the day. Because not only are people dying of the disease, many people who get COVID take a long time to recover. It's sort of known as long COVID, and health problems can be severe and even lifelong. Dr. Kelly Tice is Senior Medical Director, Medical Affairs at Florida Blue. She's hosting a webinar about this Thursday. We've got a preview right now. Dr. Tice, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Okay, so as we know, cases and hospitalizations are through the roof again in Jacksonville. People that haven't been vaccinated yet need to get vaccinated. You're going to be talking about this, and in particular, the long-term effects of COVID-19 at your webinar Thursday. Tell us a little bit more about what we know about long COVID and how severe it is for people who are dealing with it.
Well, Melissa, I think that's the problem. What we know is that some percentage of folks who have COVID, somewhere between 20 and 25% perhaps of those who have been infected with this virus will have long-term complications related to COVID. And that means that 30 days or more after their infection, they will still be dealing with symptoms related to COVID. The reason I said that's a problem is because it's not well quantified. These are emerging data, and the science around this is changing as we speak. For that reason, I think we want to raise awareness for those who remain vulnerable to this infection, so who are either ineligible for vaccine or have chosen to remain unvaccinated. We want to raise awareness in order to help people prevent these impacts that I fear they're not aware of at all.
Yeah. My own friend and coworker, Heather Schatz, her son is not even a teenager yet, and he's been battling long COVID for months. And it's terrible. You know, you wouldn't wish it on anyone. Can you talk about some of the health impacts that long COVID patients are seeing?
Sure. The most typical, most common impacts have to do with lung issues. So chronic shortness of breath, an inability to tolerate activity, so being very, very tired with just minimal exertion or exercise, a feeling of being deconditioned, terribly fatigued. There can be impacts in the nervous system, headaches, what folks are describing as a mental fog, an inability to think clearly and to perform either in an academic setting or in work setting. There are folks who have chronic pain as a result of this, another neurologic impact where folks can have pain in a limb that really defies other explanations. We're also seeing impacts in the blood vessels, so blood clotting events, damage to organs like the kidneys. We're seeing arrhythmias, so rhythm problems in the heart, palpitations, those sorts of things. And that's really the challenge. Because the impact can be so varied but be so severe, it is difficult to predict what impact you might have. And it's also important that folks recognize that even if your COVID wasn't diagnosed, we're seeing people who develop these symptoms, 3 months down the road and aren't even aware that they had had COVID, which means it can impact people even with mild disease.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about some numbers. The positivity rate in Duval County for the virus last week was nearly 22%. In Nassau County, it's above 24%. The overwhelming majority of people hospitalized or dying are unvaccinated. The vaccine is incredibly effective at preventing severe illness or death. I don't know how many more times we have to say this to get this through people's heads, that your best protection right now from getting sick or dying is to get the vaccine. Perfectly healthy people, young people, are coming into the hospital very ill. Okay, let's talk about the vaccination rate, Dr. Tice. As of last Friday's Department of Health report, Duval County's vaccination rate is 49%. The rate around Florida is 59%. Florida Blue, like so many other major players in this city, is begging people to get vaccinated. You're going to see a big push on this later today from Mayor Curry. You're going to see more corporations joining in. What's your message, Dr. Tice, from Florida Blue to those out there who aren't convinced they need the vaccine?
Well, I think I would acknowledge first that those who are reluctant at this point, many of them may feel as though they don't have all their questions answered about the vaccine itself. I know no one out there would choose to have one of these catastrophic impacts for themselves or for someone that they love. So the choice at this point to remain unvaccinated, I think, speaks to the idea that we have some misconceptions about the vaccine that drive this reluctance. And in fact, we know more about the vaccine than we do about the potential disease impacts. What we're seeing with COVID illness indicates that there is more opportunity for impacts, physical impacts, than we are aware of, again, as the science sort of develops. But the vaccines, that technology has been well studied. We now have delivered millions of vaccines across our country and many, many more across the globe. And so the data on the safety and effectiveness of these vaccines is actually there. The technology that's in use is technology that is well known and had been studied for decades. The concerns that some had about fertility or safety in pregnancy and all of those things, there's data now to support the safety of the use of these vaccines. And so I think the message is those who remain unvaccinated, this is the time to get off the sidelines. And if there is a question that you have that hasn't been well answered yet, look around your community and identify the resource to get an answer for yourself or for your family members. I've got 4 children. I've got 2 children that are under the age of 18. And the conversations that we had in our home and the research I did before having them both immunized really had to do with settling myself around the concerns for young people. But I reached the point where I was confident and comfortable, and I felt like I was able to make an informed decision for my children. And I am frankly very glad that we are now on the other side of completing the series of vaccines for them. So I just want everybody to get off the sidelines and understand that we have in our toolkit the means to reduce the impact of this disease.
Yeah.
We've just
and it's free. It is literally free and on every corner. And people in countries around the world that have no access to vaccines are desperate for vaccines. And yet here in this country, thanks to political polarization and misinformation that has led people down to falsely believe they don't need to get vaccinated, people are not getting vaccinated. And that is endangering them, their loved ones, and everyone else. So, Dr. Tice, with all of that said, how can people join your webinar Thursday?
Well, we do have a link that we can provide folks to sign up for the webinar. I'm happy to report that we have more than 1,200 people who are registered to date, and so we'll certainly provide that. And we hope that you'll join. We always do some question and answer at the end of each one of our webinars. And you can be certain that if we don't get to your question while we are on air tomorrow, that I always make sure to get to each one of them, and we get those answers out to you by email if necessary.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kelly Tice, Senior Medical Director at Florida Blue, for joining us. And I'm sure people will learn a lot when they join you virtually on Thursday. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Tice is also the clinical lead for Florida Blue's COVID-19 response. Now, as I mentioned, we do expect Mayor Curry to have an announcement later today about the increasingly urgent call for vaccinations in this community. WJCT News will cover that and bring you updates throughout the afternoon right here on 89.9 and also at WJCT.org. In a moment, some good news for your week, including the Don't Miss a Beat Jazz Festival this weekend. That's next.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at VickersLanding.com. Community First Mortgage Champions are committed to offering a great rate, a quick close, and fewer costs at closing. Accepting applications at CommunityFirstFL.org. Community First Credit Union, federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
I'm Robin Young. A decade ago, a Canadian man traded a paperclip for an item of higher value and kept going until he ended up with a house. Trading up, bartering. We'll talk to two students trying to pay off their loans.
It quickly just kept escalating, went to a snowboard, a smart thermostat, to an Apple HomePod, and then a Canon camera bundle.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Amir Questlove Thompson talks about directing the new film Summer of Soul, documenting the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival. It features performances by Nina Simone, Stevie Wonder, Mahalia Jackson, and others, and reflects on the cultural and political changes of the time. We'll also talk about big changes in Questlove's life. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Henry Ford often gets the credit for the five-day work week. What would he think of the push to make it just four?
The four-day week is better for productivity, it's better for the environment, and it's better for a work-life balance.
It's working for Iceland, Ireland's giving it a go, but could it happen here? Next time on 1A.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, don't miss a beat. The Jacksonville nonprofit with a mission to inspire through artistic discovery says it's hosting the Don't Miss a Beat Jazz Festival this Saturday at Woodstock Park. It's a family-friendly event with an incredible lineup of artists performing alongside big headliners, and admission is free. I got a preview from founder Ulysses Owens Jr. This sounds like a lot of fun. What do you have planned?
So basically, we have a combination of local amazing artists like LPT. We also have Eric Carter on guitar. We've got the Let's Ride Brass Band. And then we have some national artists like Alicia Otuja, and Matthew Whitaker, who's been on 60 Minutes, incredible jazz phenom. And then we have some other talent as well. You know, and so it's going to be a blend of not only just international and national artists like the Jazz Festival, but at the end, they will be backed by myself with a house band. And so it's really my goal to bring together kind of this combination of local talent on the same stage as the international and national talent, which many times the local talent is only opening act, or many times they're on sort of like a side stage. But I want them to understand they're just as great as these other artists that are touring the world.
That's great. Now, over the years, you've really grown Don't Miss a Beat. Tell me a little bit about the evolution of your organization.
Well, man, first of all, we have to say thanks to, you know, Jax Parks, Kids Hope Alliance, Allison, all those guys that have been there to help us. I would say we started out as really just a community program that was just focused on kids just getting exposed to the arts. And that was really our mission for the first 2 to 3 years. And then we shifted to being in the Brooklyn Riverside community at the J.S. Johnson Center. And again, you know, our goal was just to serve as many kids as possible. Then we kind of started shifting to partnerships with people like La Villa and Douglas Anderson, UNF, FSCJ, and then it became, not only are we going to help any child, but now we want to help them and put them on a path of artistic success. So now we have a feeder program that starts as early as 5 through La Villa, then connecting the kids to DA, and then our ultimate goal is to get them to college. And so now we have partners all over the world. We even have 2 graduates this year. Both got accepted to Berklee College of Music and Boston Conservatory. So now we're producing conservatory-level talent, as opposed to before it was just about transforming the lives of any child. Now it's transforming them, but then putting them on a path to success in college, which will then transform their own environment and their own family situation.
That is so inspiring. It's so great to see this. This is also free. Free event.
It's free, and yeah, it's free. And it's another key thing I want to say, Melissa, is it's at Woodstock Park. Woodstock Park is on Beaver Street. It's a part of the Rail Yard District. And this is the first time a festival of this magnitude is coming to the community. And that's why I'm dubbing it the Community Jazz Festival. You've never had this kind of talent set up in a neighborhood where someone can literally look in their backyard or across the street and come and check out this kind of talent. Normally, you have to go downtown or to Daly's Place or pay for a ticket. Mm-hmm. We're saying, hey, we're bringing world-class talent to your neighborhood because you are worth that. This community deserves that, and that is what makes me really excited.
Well, it sounds amazing. So everybody, mark your calendars now for the Don't Miss a Beat Inaugural Jazz Festival at Woodstock Park, coming up July 24th from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m., a family-friendly affair. Check out local talent and national and international headlining artists. More at don'tmissabeat.org. And he is the incredibly talented founder, Ulysses Owens Jr., Jacksonville's own standout. So, Ulysses, congrats, and I'm sure it's going to be a great time.
Thank you, Melissa, for all of your support. I always love being on your show and speaking to you.
Have fun with that. And also, speaking of music, a big shout out to Prelude Chamber Music, Inc., a local nonprofit teaching professional chamber music to local students. They've partnered up with Friday Musicale, the premier concert presenter in historic Riverside. And Friday Musicale will be the setting for an amazing 6 free concerts during their summer festival. Check those out. Well, today marks 200 years since the creation of St. Johns County. Officials there hosted a time capsule ceremony at the St. Johns County Administration Building, kind of cool and romantic, we say. By the way, right up here, up the road in Duval, Jacksonville is preparing to host its own 200th birthday next year. St. John's does have Duval beat by 1 year. And also in St. John's County, the National Society of Colonial Dames of America here in Florida is hosting an event at the Jimenez Fadio House Museum in St. Augustine Saturday. It's called Four from Home. A team of military veterans are joining the 2021 Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge, rowing 3,000 nautical miles across the Atlantic Ocean to raise awareness about veteran suicide and PTSD. Pretty incredible effort. You can look at their website, FOAR4FromHome.com, for more. And if you have some good news you'd like us to add to our weekly menu, send us an email, and we'll try to mention it on Wednesday. A little blast of sunshine to get you through the hump day. Thanks for listening so much. We so appreciate it. And thanks so much as well to producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. As I said, it's easy to get a hold of us. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Check out our podcast. It's up later today on all platforms. You can always listen as well through the WJCT app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. And as I said earlier, and as we say every day, if you haven't been vaccinated, don't listen to misinformation. Don't assume you can't get sick. Go get the shot, please. Because people are dying and getting sick in this community at disturbingly high rates. Go get vaccinated. That's our best defense. And have a good day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.